Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not able to be with us today, so I'm flying solo. And that's maybe kind of apropos for the book we're discussing today. Our guest is Tammy Charles, and she is the author of Muted, which is a novel in verse, which was really fun to read, even though it's a pretty heavy topic in some ways, but just wow. Anyway, Tammy is the critically acclaimed author of numerous books for young readers, including instant New York Times bestselling All Because You Matter. In her teens and early 20s, Tammy enjoyed a taste of fame as a member of an all-girl R&B trio. They performed for Boys to Men, BET, Showtime at the Apollo, and had a one-hit wonder on the radio. For more information about Tammy, you can see TammyWrites.com, and that's T-A-M-I, Writes.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Tammy.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. How do you go from being an R&B singer to being a writer?
Bills. So my best friends and I, we kind of formed this local group right around the age of 13. And we had a really good run. We didn't quite make it. But we had a good time trying, and we lasted up until, like, college graduation. And when we graduated from college, it was the question of, you know, do we continue with this? Or, like, okay, we're adults now. We have to actually pay bills. Maybe we need to find jobs. And I kind of fell into teaching for this, like, I had a transitional year between graduating college. My mom said, hey, I'm going to give you a year to just kind of find yourself. So I started substitute teaching, and I became addicted. I loved it. I loved working with kids, and it was through my teaching that I rediscovered my love of writing and, you know, my continued passion for books. And it was my students who said, because we were writing stories together, performing, you know, performing our work in front of the school, parents, communities, and they said, Miss Charles, you should really think about becoming an author. Oh. And so I did. And so I gave it a try. So yes, I went from wannabe Beyonce to teacher to now author.
Now, for some people, the author bit is like the big dream.
Always was. Yeah, so it kind of was a parallel dream. Of course, I enjoyed performing, but I'm the daughter of a teacher. My mom was the teacher at my school that I attended. Then she became the vice principal and then the principal within a very short time. So she constantly fed me books. So I grew up devouring books. So I always wanted to be an author. I just didn't think that I could, and I think that has a lot to do with representation. The books that I read growing up, they just weren't that diverse. So as much as I loved reading them, it was one of those things where I thought, well, maybe that's not a career for me. But when I started teaching, I realized that, oh, there's a lot more diverse books available now for today's children than I found available when I was a child. So seeing that and seeing that level of representation is also what kind of sparked my interest. Like, oh, maybe there is a space for me.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because we had this conversation with another guest recently about representation. Mm-hmm. and how important it is. And actually it was, I had the book here a little bit ago, but it was two Asian American authors writing a children's book.
Okay.
And, you know, my grandkids are Asian American, and so it really does, I think, make a difference if you you see. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about seeing yourself on the page, but even if, let's say, that particular character is not from your culture, there's also that sort of, like, seeing the world through someone else's eyes, which is really important. I think reading about cultures outside of our own helps us build understanding and empathy. And it's really what I was witnessing as a teacher. I witnessed this unfold in my classroom with my students. We were reading books by Kwame Alexander, Carol Boston Weatherford, Meg Medina. So my kids were reading all types of literature that 12-year-old me would have loved. Mm. So, yeah, it really has been a joy to contribute, you know, to that diverse canon of literature.
So tell us about the story of Muted.
Yes, okay. So I often start by saying Muted is the story that I didn't want to write. But I had to. I had written Muted in prose about 7 years ago, and it was just 60-some-odd pages of a manuscript about a girl on a plane ride home who had gotten into a bunch of trouble trying to become famous. And on this plane ride home, she's retelling the story of how she got herself in trouble, and she's sort of apologizing to her parents along the way. That storyline, or that shell of the story, remained the same, but for some reason, I really couldn't get past 60 or so pages. And I think there were like maybe one or two problems. First being that the original version of Muted, which was called something else at the time, this girl just wanted to do all the things. She wanted to be famous across the board, singing, modeling, dancing, acting. Like, there was no focus to her goals. Like, she just wanted it all. And then there was that, you know, just writing it in straight prose. Something about that, and I normally write my novels in prose. I'll sprinkle in poetry, but something about that just stifled me. And so I kept shelving that particular project. I had went on submission to different publishing houses with a different story, and I had gotten a rejection from one of the major publishers. It was a nice rejection, but the editor told my agent, hey, I just checked Tammy's website, and I see one of her fun facts listed is that in the 1990s, she was in an R&B singing group with her friends. If she ever writes about that, I want to see it. And I said, what? Like, I'm not going to write about that. What could I possibly have to say? Well, fast forward a little bit more, the Me Too movement really started gaining traction. And, you know, as a society, we started seeing all these names popping up in headlines of men who have abused their power to weaken women and to take advantage, you know, of their power, of their talent. And specifically in the music industry, which I felt was not getting enough shine. And I said, oh, wait a minute. I know that world. Mm-hmm. I can write that story. So that's, for me, that's when everything clicked. When I realized, okay, I was writing about a girl who just wanted to be famous all around. Here's the real story. I feel like every author pours a piece of themselves into their work. And once I shifted my thinking, especially knowing some things that I witnessed personally in the music industry that that I've been, you know, kind of sugarcoating, I said, wait a minute. Well, I can tell this story and infuse a little bit of my teenage years. So that's how Muted came about.
Well, of course, that begs the question, how much of this story did you really experience? Because there's some pretty heavy duty.
Oh, there's some
stuff
there's
in
definitely
here.
Some heavy things. I drew from some experiences, but I also largely drew from the headlines.
Okay.
So it's you know, Scholastic Press, they tout this book as a ripped from the headlines novel in verse, and it certainly is. There's lots of names that you can Google as far as musicians and R&B stars who have done the things that you'll read about in Muted. I often hesitate to name those particular men, and here's why. I don't think they deserve to have their names mentioned, if I'm being quite honest. I think the focus is that as a society, we need to listen to the women. Those are the people who need to be lifted up. We need to believe them when they say that, you know, they've experienced some form of exploitation, some form of abuse, especially when these stories mount and there's more than one woman saying that, you know, this particular R&B star did this to me. So I think it's more about shining a light on the women and listening to their stories and amplifying their voices. But yes, I saw some things. I'll say this much. I'm one of the lucky ones. I didn't go all the way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't one of these singers who made it to the Grammys. At the time, it was very heartbreaking because that's clearly what we wanted as a group. But in many ways, I think it was a blessing in disguise, because when I look at some of the biggest names in music and what they've had to go through just to get their voices heard, just to reclaim their power, it's not something that I think I would have handled well. I'm one of the ones who came out of the industry unscathed, but I'm also one of the ones who is nameless. Like, you're not going to find me in the stratosphere of Google, because at the time when my girls and I were doing this, you know, YouTube wasn't a thing. Instagram wasn't a thing. And now that I think about it, thank God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So in your intro, it says you had a one-hit wonder. Are you willing to share what that was?
No, even that. So I know it's probably like, what is this girl talking about? But here, again, this was such a roller coaster period of my life. I think if I was a solo artist, I would probably be a lot more forthcoming. But I was in a group with two other women, well, young girls at the time, but, you know, we're all women now, we're moms now, and they lead very private lives, you know. So out of respect for them, all I say is this. I would hope that the reader would trust that I wrote this story from a place of experience and from a place of know-how. This is an industry that I was in from about 13 to about 22 years old. And we had our good times and we had our heartbreaks. We definitely did not make it to the top. This was during a time where the market was super saturated with R&B groups, girl groups especially. So it was very difficult to get seen and be heard. But we had our little moment and it was fun.
Oh. So in Muted, you've got three girls, and
yes.
One of them realizes really early on that that fame and, you know, hitting it big as a pop, as an R&B star isn't for her.
Yeah.
Now, I think I read somewhere that you started out with
a group
of four. So
yep.
was this something that you really were able to write from personal experience, part of it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, because, like I said, and this is where the experience comes in. When my friends and I formed this group, originally, yes, there were four of us. Then the drama ensued. Things happened. And we lost one. And then there were three. So when you see that particular plot thread in the story, that's exactly what happened with my group. Mm-hmm. Now, instead, you'll see that this story starts out with a trio, and then at some point, one of the girls says, you know what? I can't do this anymore. This isn't for me. But pretty much the same, along the same lines of someone just realizes, I'm going to go. I'm not doing this anymore. Little red flag.
Right.
So that's something like what happened with us. We definitely lost one, very much like Denver and Dali loses one in the book as well.
Now, as I'm reading this, I had a feeling that it was written about a specific R&B star that we, you know, male.
Oh, you know who it is.
The villain, yeah. And,
but it's not just him, though.
But I didn't.
There's a few. Yeah, there are
really
a few like him.
Follow that case that much? Did he actually go as far as this guy did?
Separating people, keeping them hidden away.
Well, no, that I
them.
Knew about, but maybe more of the sort of, I mean, about the, like, the girls not even knowing the other ones were there.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, I think that was my own. That might have been my own level of fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's, like, really creepy.
It's a bag of a lot of things, you know. You've got the ripped from the headlines. You've got a little bit of my own personal experience in the music industry. Those scenes where they're singing and they're in the studio and yeah, that scene where they lose one of the members, that's all authentic to my experience. But then there's also the fact that, hey, I'm a writer and I have to infuse my own writing voice and it is fiction. So there are some pieces in there too. So you kind of, throw all three in a bag, and that's kind of how I crafted the story. A little truth, a little experience, and a little fiction as well.
That's a great line. A little truth, a little experience, and a little fiction.
Yep.
All right. Well, as you were writing this then, what point, so you got the message from the publishing company that they'd be interested in seeing something about your experiences as an R&B singer. You had this piece.
Refused.
You refused.
Because I didn't, you know, I was scared. Honestly, you know, fear will eat you alive sometimes. And it was just like, I didn't want to reveal that part of my life and that part of myself. And I'm still, even though I wrote the story, there are still pieces in that story that I'm like, oh man, okay, that's hard to talk about. I don't know if I want to talk about that or this, but in the end, you know, I just wrote the story and I really hoped that it would speak to someone somewhere, because there are lots of young women who have stars in their eyes. And they want to be models, or they want to be actresses or singers, or, you know, fill in the blank. And I really, really want them to be aware of, okay, I'm stepping into a territory that is unfamiliar and that can be a bit of a roller coaster. Let me do this wisely. So once I kind of put that on my shoulders, I knew I had a responsibility to just see it through.
And how did you figure out you needed to do this in poetry?
Oh, so like I said, I wrote it in just straight prose at first, just, you know, paragraph format. It was not working. Once I realized that the main character, Denver, was in a singing group, and I realized, oh, that was me. Well, when I was in a singing group, I wrote songs, and so did my two fellow singers in the group. So I said, oh, okay, well, Denver is going to be the songwriter. I wanted Denver to kind of be the leader and almost like the star of the group. And once I figured that out, I said, okay, she's a songwriter. She has to have songs in the book. And then I said, well, what if I just wrote the book so that the whole book feels like an album, an experience, a spoken word performance. That once those ideas started spinning in my head, I said, okay, I got to shift gears here. I got to write this in verse. It just made sense as a songwriter, singer-songwriter, to put the whole thing in verse. And it was not easy.
I bet. But it works. It
Thank
definitely
you.
Works. And, you know, you're... One of the things I think that makes it work is you are kind of skipping around in time and place.
Yes.
From page to page, but it's very well defined where you are. You know, you have date cues in here and
social posts.
Yes, and text streams. And
yes.
So you're giving it a lot of context. So it's not, it's very, very different than your typical narrative paragraph by paragraph book, which makes it, I don't know, more sort of present, more immediate.
Thank you. I was hoping to write something. So it's about 416 pages. Now, if that were 416 pages of paragraphs, I think it would have been a longer read. One of the key pieces of feedback that I have gotten so many times is that the book feels like a roller coaster and it reads like one. So several people have told me that they read it quite fast, which that really warms my heart because I know it's not the easiest read. There are heavy topics and heavy themes, but because it's so heavy, I try to just, let me zip you right through this. I don't want to torture you and like, you know, make it drag and drag. So I found that poetry also sped up the reading.
I could see that. Yeah. And yeah, it would have been, I don't know. You just did a great job with the verse.
I appreciate that.
You really did. And there's a lot of, what would you say? I can't remember the word for it back when I studied poetry, but how the words are placed on the page, the pattern of the word placement. Is there a special word for that?
There probably is. I'm just going to say pattern. Like I said, my big goal was to make it feel like a roller coaster. So some of those lines are zigzaggy and some of them go down and some of them go up. And if you really think about what it feels like to be on a roller coaster, that was my intention in word placement.
And some of them are like, almost like like drawing a picture with the words on those.
Yep.
So did you do all of that or did you have help with that?
So in the manuscript, I did that. But like there's a part in the book where after they have this big fight with, you know, the three girls and their parents, and now they're down to two singing group members. So now they're essentially a duo. They have a meeting with the superstar, Sean Mercury Ellis, and he gives the girls and their moms a recording contract. Well, since I'm telling the story from Denver's point of view, she's so excited to get this contract. It is so validating for her that when she looks at the contract, in her mind, it is a page with flashes of starlight, and the only words that appear in her mind are the words that apply to her. Artist. No one's ever called her that. Of course I'm going to make sure that on this black page, the word artist is there in all caps. Acceptance. That's another word that she sees on the page. She's finally being accepted as an artist, which is what she's wanted all along. And of course, you know, signature. Sign on the dotted line, and I will make all your dreams come true. Mm-hmm. So did I blacken the page like that? No, but I did direct the publisher as far as my thinking of how the page should look.
Now, you've worked in the picture book format before, correct?
Yes.
So did that come into play? Do you think your experience with that?
Oh, big time. Yeah, when I wish, oh my gosh, I just wish I could draw. But when I write my picture books, I think a lot about what the art should look like. I try to make sure that I'm not too wordy, because when you're writing a picture book, it's not just about me, the author. Like, there needs to be space for both of us to shine, myself and the illustrator. So I try to write it in a way where I'm already thinking of what is it that the illustrator can do with my words. And that is, that's the approach that I took with this book. It's funny that you ask, because when we went out on submission with this book, I actually had original art. Just a few poems with just some spot art. I really love Rupi Kaur. She's one of my favorite poets. And if you read one of her book, like her, she has Milk and Honey, and it's these beautiful short poems. And on some of these pages, she has doodles, not like full-fledged multicolored drawings, but like these doodles are so evocative. So I did do those pieces of art, but they weren't that good. As you can see, they didn't end up in the book, but I tried.
So isn't that the way it is, though? You've got these amazing creative talents as a writer and a singer and a songwriter, but you want to be an artist.
In my heart of hearts, I would love that, but I know deep down my art isn't that good. Even for Rupi Kaur, when you look at Rupi's work, it looks so simple, but I would venture to say that it's not, because her art matches her words perfectly. It's like a song.
I really did try
to emulate that, but I didn't do so well. Well, we just figured in the end, it probably was like one element over, because we already had text messages and we had blacked out contracts and news articles. If you remember there being
yes.
a couple of news articles in
yeah.
there, so it was like, ooh, we already have like four or five elements going to now add a sixth element of pictures. Maybe that might be too visually distracting. So we just wound up not going with it. Hey, maybe one day I'll share my art on Instagram so people can laugh at me. We'll see.
I don't think they'll be laughing at you. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tammy Charles, author of Muted. He had the power, she had the voice. You know, it's easy to see how a young woman or a young man or even a full-grown adult could
yeah.
get sucked into giving up their power to somebody who supposedly has the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, the way for them to get to make their dreams come true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's no surprise. And you'd think, well, why aren't their parents watching out for them? But sometimes
you know,
the parents get sucked
easy,
in
though.
Too.
Yeah, it's really easy to fall down the rabbit hole. When I say that, you know, even though my friends and I, we came out unscathed, that's because our dads were there a lot of the time. Mm. But right around the time when I turned 17, I got my license, I got a car, and by this point, our dads had been, you know, taken off of work, driving us all around the country for, you know, for shows and auditions. And I had proven myself to be responsible. And I don't know if I offered, I'm pretty sure I did, that I offered, oh, I can chip in with this. I can take us to a few different places. You know, when that happened, there were certain dynamics that changed. And yeah, there were a few instances where it was like, hey, you know, come to the studio without your parents. Like, I remember that. And when, you know, it's easy to fall down that hole, especially
oh, yeah.
when you're thinking, oh, I'm 17. Oh, I have my license. I have a car. My parents trust me. We're just going there to sing, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can really get yourself into some sticky situations. And there were a few. Even as young as 13, I remember being solicited by someone who presented themselves as a talent manager. And at 13, I've got stars in my eyes. My girls and I, we can sing. And oh, you're a talent manager, and you want me to call you? And I did at 13. Mm. I did, and it. Like, just even thinking back then, the whole secrecy of don't tell your parents. At 13, you don't really know that that's, you know, a thing. Like, that is not
appropriate. That's a warning sign, yeah.
Yeah, that's a red flag. When you're 13, you're just like, hey, this guy's got it, and I want it.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is, now that I'm 40, I can laugh at it because you know what that guy was? He was a bus driver. Now listen, that doesn't mean you can't be both, but come on.
Oh, wow.
And
oh,
why
wow.
didn't you want to speak to my parents? So again, more validation of me writing this story and having some shady moments like those along the way that really helped me formulate the characters.
Yeah, and you may be saving somebody from some heartache.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
Well, Tammy, why don't you read for us?
Oh, yes. I have a couple of passages. I actually made little notes. So the book opens with the main character, Denver. She is on her way home. So the story, like you said, it jumps in timeline. It kind of works backwards and forward. This is Monday, December 23rd. She's at Atlanta International Airport, and she's on her way home at the airport. So this is how the book opens. Airport lines are the worst, especially during holidays. But that's not the case for us, right, Captain LaFleur? We hustle past the bustle, sight unseen, straight to the holding room, where we'll wait and wait some more before being escorted to the plane first. Pilot perks, also boss moves. This leaves plenty of time, 1 hour, 44 minutes, for me to explain how it all went down. I'm going to say some stuff you ain't going to like, but you've done some stuff I didn't like either. So maybe you'll get it. And I'm sorry, Poppy, for lying, for leaving, but not for the music. Even though it took some time to open my eyes, I fixed everything, you'll see. I muted the monster once and for all. And now I get to go home with you, just like you and Gwen and Ma wanted. But first, I gotta start from the beginning. So in that poem, I'm kind of laying the groundwork that, okay, her and her dad, they're at the airport, and she messed up big time, and she's apologizing to him and retelling the story of how she got herself in a world of trouble trying to become famous. Is it okay to share a second poem?
Of course.
Okay, so this poem, again, pulling from experience, it's on page 31 of the book. I call this poem Olive Juice. This is a very meaningful poem in my life, particularly with my husband, the love of my life. These two words we kind of grew up saying from the age of 16. If you looked in the mirror and said olive juice, no sound escaping your lips, you'd see it almost looked like, I love you. Olive juice. Those words belonged to me and Ali and no one else. A reminder, a code cloaked in two words that to others would mean absolutely nothing at all. So there's a little bit of a love interest between two of the characters. Denver and Ali, but it's all like towards the end of the book, I write that Denver sees them as a question mark in human form. These girls, all three girls, love each other as friends, of course, but Denver's bond with Dali is so strong. It's friendship for sure. It's sisterhood, but it does cross the line into love, but she's not really sure what that is, what it means. Like, she has all these questions about it. All she knows is she doesn't care that Dali is a girl. Like, Dali could have been anyone and she would have loved her just the same. So that those words, olive juice, is kind of like their code to just remind each other, hey, I love you. And it's something that I said growing up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, there was basically between the two girls kind of they were unsure about their sexual orientation.
Yes.
And what made you decide to put that element in?
Well, here's what I'll say about that. Because I had a feeling this was coming. My very generic answer is this. Anything that I write, I will always pour a piece of myself and my experience into it. So,
okay.
That.
All right. Tell me a little bit about otter hounds.
Oh, the dog. Okay. Yes. Are you a dog lover?
I am, but I am not familiar with this particular dog.
So this dog is like the biggest piece of floof. I wanted a dog that was curious. So I was like Googling, dog breeds. Now, I've had quite a few dogs, but my last dog was truly my dog. My husband and I had a beagle. And I wanted to use a beagle because our beagle, Zoe, was so curious, as most beagles are, always sniffing things. But I wanted this dog to be kind of big because I knew in the end of the story where there would be a climax, I did want the dog to kind of be involved in the fight. There's like a climax at the end.
And the dog has a role.
Right? The dog needed his own part. So I'm like, this can't be a little dog. It's got to be a big dog, a big nosy dog. And I looked through pictures, and just the otter hound was just perfect. And also expensive. Now, remember, Merc is someone who likes to flaunt his power and flaunt his wealth. And there's that scene where when he gifts Denver this dog, he makes sure to let her know, this dog costs a lot of money. And he doesn't even let her – she wanted to name the dog Fluffy, and he doesn't even let her do that. He tells her, no, the dog's name should be Chance. Why? Because you're taking a chance to follow your superstar dreams. He's so controlling, even down to the dog. He wanted the most expensive dog. He wanted to name the dog. But what he didn't realize in the end was that this dog would be fiercely loyal to Denver, except right at the end. Because, dogs who are that nosy, of course, they're going to be guided by their senses. So there is a scene where the dog just kind of runs away as they're arguing. But for the most part, Chance is a fierce and loyal companion. And Chance is like an inspiration to Denver because Chance is really the one who kind of inspires her to start digging and start really rethinking her decision for following this guy. It's Chance that does that. Well, dogs can be inspirations too.
I'm looking at pictures of otter hounds, and they're kind of like sheepdogish almost.
Exactly.
They got hair in their face, right? Hair in their eyes.
It's like a big ball of poof.
And they look a little bit guilty all the time.
Yep. Yeah, they're so cute.
I really
had to have an otter hound. So, yeah,
and they look like they can get pretty big.
They do. They get huge.
Wow.
So I said, okay, we're going with an otter hound and not a beagle. Maybe I'll reserve the beagle for my next book.
All right. So when you really sat down to write this, did you know how it was going to end?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Even 7 years ago, I knew the beginning. I knew she was on a plane ride home. Like, and that I knew that those first few pages would be, hey, I'm on this flight home, and since I've got all this time, almost 2 hours, let me tell you how I got in trouble trying to become a star. I knew that that was the beginning.
Okay.
And I also knew how the story would end.
Okay.
It's the middle that always
it's the middle that's the problem.
Yes, it's always those nagging middles. So, yeah. I knew it from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about some of your other books, because you've got quite a few.
Okay.
How many books have you published?
altogether, I have either 19 or 20 published slash forthcoming.
Wow.
So my first published book was 2018, and that was Like Vanessa. Again, just really diving into either, you know, I draw from my personal experiences. I draw from family experiences, like shared family experiences. Like Vanessa is the story of a 13-year-old girl who witnesses the first woman of color win Miss America. And that kind of inspires her to enter a contest at school, even though the school bully and her father, they don't think that she stands a chance to win. Now, again, drawing on experience, I did my first pageant at 13, and it was a terrifying experience. So that was my first novel, kind of semi-autobiographical. I kind of experienced a little bit of bullying when I decided to try out for a pageant. After Like Vanessa, I've published quite a few other middle grade novels. I have the Definitely Daphne series, which is like a spin on Hannah Montana, a girl who accidentally becomes a YouTube star. Like, she goes viral overnight. She's awkward and shy. I mean, that was me kind of when I was like 12, 13.
Okay. Tammy, I just have one question here. Did you really say that your first novel was 2018?
Yes. That was
And you've published 19 or 20? How is that even possible?
I'll say this. When you have a dream for yourself that at first you don't think there's even space for you, right? You're a kid, you're growing up, you read these books, and you're like, I'd love to do this, but I can't do this because I'm not rich, because I'm not old, because I'm not white. So, okay, let me try something else. And then when that dream sparks again through children, through the eyes of children who make you feel like, hey, you can do this, now you're playing catch up. So you write all the books. you wake up at 4 in the morning and you get to work. So that's literally what happened. And even when I entered this industry, like when I tried, I started trying around 2008, 2009. I was going to conferences and joining critique groups. And I think most writers experience, you know, rejection. I was getting rejected left and right. And I know why, because I think it was because I was trying to write the types of stories that I read growing up. I really wasn't writing stories that pulled from pieces of my life, like Vanessa, like Muted, you see?
Wow.
So it wasn't until I took a step back. It was actually an editor. I had dinner with an editor, and she's asking me questions about my life, and I told her, at 13, I joined a pageant, and I did this and that. And she goes, wait, why aren't you writing about that? That's your book. That's your published book. And so I did. And once I did, there was no stopping me. So everything that I write, for the most part, I just pull from me. I pull from 12-year-old me, 17-year-old me. I pull from, you know, family gatherings. I have a very, at least I think, I have a very interesting family dynamic. So I pull
what
from all
of
that.
What makes it so interesting?
My husband is Haitian. So his family is from Haiti. And I've known him since I was 10. I liked him at 16, and now I'm 40. I turned 41 on Monday. So, you know, he's been a part of my life for so, so many years. So those stories that are personal to me, I write. But having been in his family, that's my family too. I tell people all the time, I am in some ways closer with my husband's family than I am with certain parts of my own family. So that's where stories like Freedom Soup come to life, and My Day with the Poignet. If you see, even with a Muted, you'll see that she's half Haitian. Her father is Haitian. That's just me pulling from my own family dynamic and those stories and those gatherings of, you know, jokes and stuff that make us who we are as a family.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Tammy Charles, author of Muted, a novel in verse. What about, you had a picture book come out quite recently that became a New York Times bestseller.
Yes.
All Because You Matter. What is that book?
So All Because You Matter. Wow. Okay. So here's another book that I didn't want to write, but When the Voice Calls, You Must Answer. It's a picture book, part love letter, part anthem, you know, this reminder. Initially, I wrote it for my son, but it ballooned into something much greater, just to remind children of their worth and that their worth can never be diminished. I wrote it from a place of a mother's love. When I discovered that I was pregnant, like most moms, I was so excited. But as a woman of color, I was a little scared. We see the headlines. We see the names of young lives, black lives, being taken brutally and far too soon in many cases. And I remember just wanting to keep my little boy shielded from the reality and the pain of that. So I did not have any, like, conversations with him for a long time. I thought I could keep him shielded from things that he may see on the news that he may find scary. But right around kindergarten, I realized, oh, boy, I'm not going to be able to do this forever. He learned about Dr. King. He came home. He wanted to know, Mommy, if Dr. King was a good guy and he wanted peace for all of us to be together, black and white, then why did the bad guys hurt him? So as early as 5, I realized, okay, I have to do something because these questions will not stop, and they haven't ever since then. And I just realized what better way to spark conversation than to start it from a place of love and to start it from a place of reminding my son of his worth and that he has family and a community who will help him navigate through life. So I wrote All Because You Matter to remind him of that, so that he will always feel safe to come to me and speak what's on his mind or ask questions about what he may see or stumble on the internet that he may find disturbing or curious, or he may be curious. So once I did that, I said, well, this is a book for him. And then I realized, no, well, this is a book for kids who look like him, you know, children of color, children from marginalized backgrounds. And then I said, whoa, wait, oh, this is a message for all children. Because even if you are a child and you are not from a BIPOC community, it's equally important for you to know empathy and kindness and treating your friends with respect and being an ally and being an upstander, not a bystander. So that's where, you know, all of these themes kind of ballooned out of this one love poem that I wrote to my son one morning after having a dream about this book. I dreamt the art. I dreamt the words. I woke up. I wrote them down. I read them to my husband, and my husband said, you got to send that to your agent right now. That was on a Friday, and by Monday, she sent it off, and I think by Tuesday we had a book deal. We had an auction, really. There were quite a
what?
Few publishers who, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it came out in October?
That published October 6th, yes.
Wow. So when you say you dreamt the pictures, it looks like you have an amazing illustrator.
Oh, Brian Collier, let me shout him out. So, and the other thing, and this never happens, well, it almost never happens, when I dreamt up the story and I dreamt up the art and I woke up, well, through the dream, I knew that that was Brian's art because I'm a fan. I knew it. So when we when we went out on submission, I even told my agent, I said, listen, this is probably a long shot, but if any of these publishers, if they want it, if they can get me Brian Collier,
that's our guy.
And Scholastic was more than happy to deliver.
Wow.
And he was too, obviously, because he, you know, it was up to him to decide if he wanted the project, and he loved the words, and he signed on too. So I'm so fortunate that he loved it.
Well, this is like such an amazing story, but of course you had done picture books before, so I'm sure that helped in getting the attention, getting the project the attention so quickly. But even so, it's like, wow. And what are you working on now?
Well, I like to jokingly say that this pandemic has paused my author career, and I am now my son's personal assistant for the past year.
How old is your son?
He's 11, and he is in virtual school. I have largely been just promoting my books, and I've done tons of speaking engagements for, you know, school visits and keynote speeches. I am not writing nearly as voraciously as I was with, you know, publishing that many books in such a short amount of time. However, I do see a light at the end of the tunnel because we are fully vaccinated, and my son.
Congratulations.
Yeah, he went back to, I signed him up for like a part-time kind of in school / virtual school mix. So I think I might be getting back to my writer self. For now, I do have some poetry that I've been playing around with. I'd like to see if I can turn it into either another verse novel or perhaps a picture book.
Do you have a favorite of all these books?
No, they're all my babies. Like, there's something, you know, there's something so personal about each one. It's really hard to pick. If I had to, I'm going to say, for the simple fact that my son's face is on the cover, I'm going to say All Because You Matter. That's him on the cover. That's him throughout the book. Like, that is my legacy to him that will outlive me. It'll outlive him. So,
how does he feel about it? Is it, I mean, I've got an 11-year-old grandson, and I'll tell you, he would be a little bit embarrassed, I think, because to have that attention on him, he would find it a little bit uncomfortable.
So I have witnessed the opposite. What I think is that my son is going to be more so embarrassed by the time he hits middle school and especially high school. But for now, oh, he thinks he's famous.
Oh,
yeah.
Well,
we did an event. We did an event with the Detroit Lions, like football. We did like a read across, like the end of reading month to cap off the month of March. And they reached out to me and personally asked, would Christopher be willing, you know, like this kid, you know, he has choices. Would he be willing to, you know, show up for this event and talk about the book? And of course he did. Because those were bragging rights. He went back to school virtually telling all his friends, because they were like, why weren't you in class? Where were you on Zoom? And he's like, oh, I was doing something for the NFL. So, yeah.
Oh, of course.
He's totally living it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are certainly plenty of kids who would react that way. I think with my grandson, part of it is like he wants to be a movie director, not an actor.
Behind the scenes.
He wants
good.
To be
they make more money anyway. He's a smart kid.
He is definitely. He is definitely. So, as an author, you get to kind of be both behind the scenes
bit.
and out front.
Yeah. Can I tell you though? The running joke is with one of my fellow author friends is, I love writing in my basement, in my pajamas, with the spiders. Like, I will take that any day over hopping on a plane and, you know, making a big brouhaha out of an event. Like, I do them naturally because I have to promote my books. But there has been somewhat of a silver lining through this pandemic. It has been that I've been able to do that without leaving home. You know, so it's like, yeah, I can still do my job. I can still promote my books just virtually. And then I still get to be a mom. I like my privacy. You know, I love writing my books. But I also like living, you know, a private life, just here, writing my books from my basement. There are some of the biggest name authors, in my opinion, they're not the ones who are like super out on Instagram and Twitter. You know, they just write their books and they sell their books and they do well, and they're just not at the forefront.
Yeah.
Like that, you know.
Yeah. And
for
and
me,
of course,
that would be a dream.
And of course, in the past, authors didn't have to be such public figures. Some of them weren't at all. Now, I think for a new writer, there's a certain, you know, it's like, well, you have to have a platform. You have to have followers to even get published. Yeah. Because honestly, the two don't necessarily go hand in hand, the writing talent and the, you know, wanting to be known and famous. So
exactly.
Yeah. So
and
maybe
once upon a time I wanted to, like, I wanted to, I was Denver. I was that girl who wanted to be seen and be heard. And, you know, I'm at a different place in my life. I know that I have to do some level of, you know, showing my face, but at the heart of it all, I just want to write books.
Mm. Well, you've done a lot of them, and you've got picture books, you've got nonfiction picture books, you've got young adult, middle grade novels, and you even have a biography.
Yes, middle grade biography of Serena Williams.
And did you get to talk to her to do that?
No, I
wish.
Oh, that would have been amazing. But, you know, when I – that was actually a book that I was asked to write. I was approached about it. And I couldn't say no. It's Serena. It was the GOAT series, and they were asking, you know, writers to contribute different books for different sports that, you know, we consider these particular people the GOAT of their sport. And I just said, oh yeah, I can do that. And mind you, I really had to study because I don't play tennis at all. Well, at all. But again, just dialing back to my own experience, you know, Serena Williams was this girl from the inner city of California, and she had a dream, and she went for her dream, and she worked hard. And I'm like, okay, I can write that because that's me. I may not be a tennis player, but I was born in Newark. That's an inner city. I worked hard. So, yeah, I had to do it. Just writing about a girl with so much grit, that felt like I could pour a little bit of myself into the writing of that story.
And just for those who might not know, GOAT stands for greatest
of all
time.
Yep.
Well, Tammy, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This was fun.
This was fun. We are out of time, but we always close with a quote, and I think I found one that kind of fits with here. And this was from Henry David Thoreau.
Okay.
Who said, rather than love, than money, than fame, give me truth.
Yeah. Give me truth. I like that.
Give me truth. Thank you again, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you.